Join the ultimate competition with Bitcoin Halving Challenge presented by Bitcoin Magazine and powered by nitrobetting.eu. This is your chance to predict the future price of Bitcoin during the 2024 halving in April and snag your share of the one Bitcoin prize pool. Join the excitement today. It's free to enter. Put your Bitcoin expertise to the test and make your prediction. Will Bitcoin skyrocket to new heights or make history with a game-changing shift? Enter your guess for free at www.bitcoinhalving.com. That's www.bitcoinhalving.com. Void where prohibited by law. No purchase necessary.
All right. Look at that. Nice timing.
Let's shut out this music.
What is that music? What are you playing?
No, that's a feature on Spaces. So, while we open up the room, get people in here, we have a selection of four songs to play from.
Yeah, if we've been thinking ahead, we could have asked Troy to play a little something on the piano. Troy, I've been seeing your clips lately. Those are pretty sweet.
Yeah, I thought the piano choice was intentional.
It was. We were listening to Vibes, Alien Vibes, because it was Cosmic Bitcoin, but I switched it up on us because you hadn't joined yet, and I was like, all right, we need to impress him.
Yeah, no, it's Matthew Pines who's the aliens guy.
Yep. Well, no, we already had him on the show, and I don't think he talked about Bitcoin. So I think Matt Pines has the record for being able to convince the max amount of Bitcoin shows to let him on to not talk about Bitcoin. So he definitely has the crown there.
I'm sure he does. Matthew Pines also has a master's degree in philosophy and does philosophy of physics and metaphysics, which I do as well. I read something he wrote for his master's degree. It was actually on the same topic I wrote my dissertation on, my PhD dissertation. So he's a man of many hats. But I do not follow the alien discussion at all. I'm not a cosmic Bitcoiner in the sense of, you know, the actual cosmos. Whatsoever, but I just marvel at Matt Pine's ability to talk about it completely, like dispassionate Bayesian statistical modeling and like exhaustive knowledge of the government agencies involved. I mean, he's almost like a prodigy. He's a prodigy of how to think about aliens or something.
No, well, I mean, hey, Matt Pines is the man. I would recommend anyone who's interested in listening to our show with Matt Pines to go check out the Bitcoin Magazine podcast, or just scroll down in this feed and eventually you'll find it. I don't know if Twitter advanced search works anymore. But let's just to introduce the show before we introduce Troy formally and jump into the interview. This is Cosmic Bitcoin. This is where we bring the biggest thinkers, the most out-of-the-box thinkers, the thinkers who think about the second, third, fourth order effects of Bitcoin. We talk about those things. We talk about the big ideas. We talk about how Bitcoin affects humanity. And we got a good show for you today. We got Troy Cross, who's coming on. He is a man of many skills in terms of being able to explain Bitcoin and frame Bitcoin. And we're going to talk about, you know, the epistemology. Jeez, I'm sorry, just fumbling right there, which, you know, is it's essentially the knowledge of knowledge, or what is knowledge. And you know what that means for Bitcoin. So excited for this one. Just to do a little bit of housekeeping, obviously we're gonna have folks like Troy at our Bitcoin conferences. The next Bitcoin conference that's coming up is Bitcoin Amsterdam. That's October 12th through the 13th. So that's going to be in Amsterdam, one of the most fun cities to hang out with Bitcoiners, a great and legendary Bitcoin community there, and an awesome event coming together. So really excited for that one. Check that out. You can use promo code COSMIC to save 10%. And Bitcoin 2024, that's going to be in Nashville. Thousands of Bitcoiners have already pre-purchased their tickets to go to the next massive Bitcoin conference. And that is in now just less than a year from today. So it starts July 25th, 2024. So now it's July 26th. So it's coming up real quick here. And you can still get some of the best prices on those tickets as well. So that is enough of that. Let's jump into this conversation with Troy and talking epistemology. And Spencer, I will give you the mic to give Troy's formal introduction.
Awesome. Thank you, CK. And Troy, thank you so much for joining us today. We're really looking forward to unpacking this. And we're going to really keep the conversation focused on epistemology, trying to understand how we as individuals and as a society can attain knowledge and, you know, assuming that it's, an absolute form of knowledge is possible, kind of the nature of beliefs and also how we can justify our beliefs and things. And so this kind of relates closely to, you know, how our institutions function. Troy, yourself being a professor of philosophy and humanities at Reed College, I think you might have a unique insight into how institutions can shape and influence our ability to attain knowledge. And we're going to kind of unpack as well the role of money in Bitcoin in a potential Bitcoinized world, you know, what that will mean for institutions and our ability to pursue truth. But I guess, Troy, I'd also just kind of set the stage and say you're someone I've looked up to for a long time now. I used to be in the sustainability consulting world, and seeing your, dispensement, if that's even a word, you're, you know, tackling the environmental FUD head on has been amazing to watch. And as well, you know, you are a fellow at the Bitcoin Policy Institute, and y'all are doing great work over there as well. And I know you work with Matthew Pines too, who we mentioned earlier in the conversation. But yeah, Troy, I'd say you're someone who's, you know, been able to talk across, you know, all sides of the political spectrum, handle criticism, dish it out when necessary. And, you know, I think you're an excellent communicator for the Bitcoin space. So, you know, with all that aside, I think what we want to try and do today is we're going to try and, first of all, understand what is epistemology. And, you know, you're going to be a great person to explain that. And we're also going to try to understand how we make sense collectively as a society and a culture. And, you know, try to understand, you know, what philosophy you can offer us in trying to unpack, you know, what does Bitcoin truly fix? And, you know, are there limits to that as we try to make sense of the world? First off, Troy, I was just hoping if you could just tell us a little bit more in depth, you know, what philosophical questions are you interested in answering? And, you know, what commands the focus of your study at Reed College?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you guys for inviting me. I really appreciate it. I've listened to Cosmic Bitcoin on a number of occasions, and I love the way you guys do things, and I hope I can make good on that. Super kind, really, really nice introduction. You guys sent me some questions earlier. Thinking about these questions, it's freaking hard. It's easier to talk about energy. It's easier to talk about Bitcoin than to talk about the thing that I actually study and do with my life, which is philosophy. You know what it's like to try to tell a complete newbie about Bitcoin? They don't know anything about it at all. And everything that comes out of your mouth either sounds technical or crazy or just completely unfamiliar to your audience. And so your audience is like, I mean, it's just, it actually gets harder the more you know about Bitcoin. You know what I'm talking about? When you first learned about Bitcoin, you could explain it better than you can now. And like to a rank newbie, it's true, because you start talking to other Bitcoiners, you can build on a lot of common knowledge. So that's the way it is for me with epistemology. I speak a highly specialized language of epistemology that other people who are also professors of philosophy get, and also advanced students in philosophy. And not to ourselves, but this is actually kind of the problem. Epistemology, it's just as you said, it's the study of knowledge, the study of justification, of rationality, and it asks these really broad questions like, what is knowledge? Does anybody know anything? And what would it mean to know something? How do we know things individually and collectively? How do we organize ourselves socially to have knowledge? Or if we have any knowledge at all? And what is rational belief? What is the right way to believe? And are there rules, just like there are ethical rules for right behavior? Are there rules for right belief? Can they be formalized? Can they be made into math and logic? or are they impossible to formalize and more like rules of thumb? And those are some of the basic questions of epistemology. It's basically like, I think of it like this. The goal in action, when you're trying to act, is to make the world conform to your mind. Like you have a desire, you want to fulfill that desire. You make the world match how you want the world to be. But you're making the world fit with the mind. The goal in epistemology and the goal in knowledge is the opposite. You try to make the world match the mind, but not by changing the world, but by changing your mind. So you're creating a world mind fit, but the direction of fit is mind to world rather than world to mind. And epistemology is really the study of that. How best to make your mind conform to the world? Are the rules and principles of it? How do you do it? It's not the only subject that I work on at Reed, and I've worked on it previously. I taught at Oxford University in England, Yale University in Connecticut, and I did my PhD at Rutgers University and taught there as well. And most of the time I've been at these places, I've really been into metaphysics, which is a study of being broadly, or the most fundamental aspects of reality. Those are the two primary focuses of my interest in philosophy. Both of them are specialized. Both of them I have a hard time even talking about to normies who do not study it. But both of them I can spend weeks talking to other philosophers about. So I'm hoping in this spaces to try to reach across the technical boundary, you know, just like a Bitcoiner talking to a noob. But I'm just saying ahead of time, it's freaking hard, and it's harder than anything else I have to do as a communicator. I will do my best not to be boring and or obscure. And please interrupt me like whenever I'm doing one of those two things.
Well, yeah, certainly appreciate the heads up there. And yeah, I mean, in preparation for this interview, there was just like, it immediately struck me like, oh my gosh, there is like almost a never ending rabbit hole to go down here as far as like, what can we know? What does it mean to like observe something? How do we know we are in fact observing that thing? And it ultimately calls into the forefront of my mind, like a question of skepticism that is just so hard to defeat. And then kind of the opposition of skepticism with, I suppose a common sense point of view where, you know, we can accept what we you know, perceive as being real. And there's like a very strong tension between those two things. But all that being said, I think on Cosmic Bitcoin, you know, we like to stretch our minds a little bit here and give people the opportunity to chase anything that they're interested in down another rabbit hole. So, you know, if there is a time where you feel like you're being a little bit, I guess, esoteric, I think that's fine. I think it's going to give people the opportunity to educate themselves further and be a good jumping off point. But yeah, I guess, you know, to kind of kick things off, I think it would be good for you to just, you know, in a very simple way, just lay out, you know, what does it mean to believe something? And how do we, you know, decide whether or not our beliefs are true? And like, kind of what are the limits to that? And we can break it down a little bit more. But yeah, what does it mean? Like, I guess you could even start as like, what does it mean to know something? But yeah, you know, you're the expert here, so I'll let you take.
Oh, good. I mean, the classes I teach are all about that question, and we answer that in the course of a semester. And I never give my students a definitive answer. You know, philosophy is like the ultimate collection of rabbit holes where we have not yet reached the bottom, and we're not even close. You know, that's like what it is. So I don't have a definitive answer to any of those questions of what is belief or what is knowledge. I'd kind of like to start with maybe the story that sets up modern epistemology, which is, there's a particular book. It's called The Meditations by René Descartes, 17th century French thinker. And Meditations is six short essays that Descartes writes in the first person about himself alone, in his drawing room by the fire, just thinking about this question that you actually just posed right now. What does he know? Can he be certain of anything? What is knowledge? And he begins by thinking about having been wrong in the past. You know, all of us here have been wrong about a lot of things. Not only have we been wrong about a lot of things, but we've been wrong about a lot of things we were really certain about. Right. And I say that because we're all Bitcoiners here, I assume. People tuning in are into Bitcoin. And anybody who's a Bitcoiner has been wrong about a lot of stuff before, right? Because it changes your mind about a lot. So you have that experience, and Descartes had it too. And you ask yourself, what else am I wrong about? Right? It's kind of like when you see that the media is wrong about the thing that you know about. In this case, it's Bitcoin. You ask, what else is the media wrong about? But the next question, and the better question, is like, wait a minute, but I was wrong about this. What else am I wrong about? And Descartes wants, like, the solution to this problem. He was a mathematician. You've heard of the Cartesian plane, Cartesian coordinates, Cartesian geometry. That's all Descartes' invention. He was a mathematician. He wanted all of his beliefs to be as certain and secure as math. And so he invents this little device to cleanse his mind of falsehood, which is, just for the sake of argument, let's assume that the worst possible scenario of being deceived or wrong is real. And that scenario for him is a being that is as powerful as God, is Catholic, as powerful as God, but evil, tries to deceive me. He calls this the evil genius or the evil demon. And he's like, suppose there's an evil demon who's trying to make all of my beliefs false. How far could he screw me up? If anything survives this like test of doubt, then it'll be a certainty, and I can build the rest of my belief system back off from that certainty. I'll be secure in it. And he starts thinking about what the evil demon, and it's weird to even talk about this now because this is 17th century, but late in the 20th century, and certainly in the 21st, this has become like a basic theme of Hollywood. It's become a theme. The Matrix, Inception. I don't know. You name your favorite sort of skeptical scenario-based Hollywood endeavor, right? But we have many of these imaginary literary devices that allow us to project ourselves into a scenario where everything we thought was true was wrong. And then we have this kind of epistemic crisis in that scenario. And Descartes notes one thing he can't be wrong about is that he is in fact doubting, that he is in fact thinking his own thoughts, that he is having these thoughts, that he is doubting. Those are secure, even though as he's sitting by the fireside, maybe that's not a real fire, but it's a mere hallucination. He sees people walking through the streets outside. Maybe they're not real people. Maybe they're automata just wearing hats and coats. Right? Maybe he has no past. He doesn't think this, but later Bertrand Russell does. Maybe the universe is only 5 minutes old and everything, the entire past is like an illusion. Your brain is constructed with false memories and then zapped into existence, and your experience is just as if there is a past, right? So we're familiar with these kinds of scenarios. But what survives is only his immediate experience and his thinking itself. And that's the foundation from which he tries to build out everything else. And, you know, he doesn't get very far. He thinks he does. He thinks he can prove the existence of God and then prove that God is good. And then prove that God wouldn't deceive us at scale if we were doing the best we could with our faculties, and we were particularly humble about it. But he doesn't get very far. And his failure spawns other attempts in epistemology to do the same thing, to arrive at absolute certainty and base everything on that. And eventually everybody fails in the field to build much of anything useful on the, you know, the I think, therefore I am type of thoughts. They just don't get you very far. And so we're stuck in the field with Descartes' dream of certainty, like just being forever in the distance. us being unable to reach it. And a lot of epistemology is just grappling with the reality that certainty isn't something realistic that we can shoot for, but that we're forever in this morass of credences or degrees of belief, degrees of certainty, degrees of justification, and that we're forever beholden to our inputs, you know, the other ways we form beliefs, not just by like reflecting on our own experiences, but people telling us stuff and us trusting them, or rather than just us trusting people, we can trust our senses. We have a sense of intuition in mathematics that we trust. But apart from like the senses, testimony of others, mathematical or logical intuition, we don't have any direct godlike way to sort the true from the false. So epistemology is about sort of, I want to say, settling. It's about settling for the only kinds of certainties and perspectives that we can have, which are always enmeshed in a social moment, a historical moment, in a fabric of beliefs that we mostly inherited from others, and is ultimately vulnerable to error that we cannot necessarily rule out. Okay, how's that for a mini lecture to start us out?
Yeah, that was absolutely phenomenal. And I think to just kind of like illustrate one way in which like our perceptions can be fallible and our ability to justify our beliefs can also be fallible. I found kind of an interesting example where, you know, somebody is trying to figure out what time it is and they want to try to justify that belief to understand whether or not their understanding of what time it is true. And they walk into a room and they look up at a clock and the clock reads noon. And they're like, oh, it's noon. And at the same time, you could say it just so happens to be noon. But what's interesting about that is, you know, it could turn out the clock could be broken and happen to be frozen at noon itself. And so I just find it so interesting to think about, you know, we could even have justification for our beliefs and those beliefs could turn out to be true. Yet it seems like there is like a limit to, you know, how if we really have direct knowledge of things. And, you know, I'm certainly not a philosophy professor, but I just found that to be like an interesting illustrative example of kind of the limits of our certainty and,
yeah,
you know, the limits of our ability to perceive.
I mean, you have no idea what sort of rabbit hole you just touched on there. That example is, I think, Russell's, Bertrand Russell's, but it was later made into a problem for theories of knowledge by Edmund Gettier in 1963. The theory of knowledge, one of the answers to your question of what is knowledge, the most famous answer, which their roots go back to Plato in his dialogue, The Theaetetus, is that knowledge is justified true belief. That is, if you know something, then you have to believe it to be true. If something turns out to be false, you thought you knew it, but you didn't really know it. And also, you have to have a reason for it or an account. You have to have good reasons for it to be true. Those are the three components: justification, truth, and belief. It's called the JTB account. And those three are individually necessary and jointly sufficient for knowledge. And the case that you just gave is a case where you have justified true belief, but not knowledge. You look at a stopped clock, you form a belief about what time it is. It's noon. Your belief is true. You have good reason to believe the clock. The clock didn't give you any, you know, you don't think it's stopped and you have no reason to think it's stopped. You believe that it's true and it's justified. And yet, it's not intuitive that you have knowledge of the time because you just got lucky. And you can get lucky while having a justification. If your standard of justification is anything less than that Cartesian absolute certainty. The examples of this are really all throughout the philosophy literature. It's called the Gettier problem. One of my favorites is... You're driving through the Vermont countryside, and you're looking at the farms, and you look over and see this barn, and you say, "Oh, look over there! There's a barn," and you're right, and it is just a regular old barn there, and yet you fail to know And the reason you fail to know is because, little do you know, you are in the middle of phony barn country. All the barns around that particular real barn are actually fake barns that are part of an elaborate movie set. They're like barn facades just facing the road with no backside. So even though you're looking at a real barn and your vision is working just fine, like, you don't know that's a barn. Yeah, this occupied epistemologists for about 30 years, from the late 60s until about 2000. Epistemology was obsessed with these cases of justified true belief that aren't knowledge, and what that shows us about what knowledge is. Yeah, that's the kind of thing that I actually do. So it's not really like what you think of when you think of philosophy, cosmic Bitcoin, these deep thoughts, these big thoughts. It's more like, here's an account of what knowledge is. Here's an exception to it. How do we patch up this account and make it elegant and make it something that works? Yeah, the thing you touched on is one of the major themes of epistemology in the late 20th century.
Yeah, CK, feel free to jump in here if you have any follow-up questions there. But Troy, I thought your example of the barn and the facade kind of highlights where we can take this conversation and kind of open it a little bit more, open it up a little bit more closely to Bitcoin and the role of institutions in helping us to understand the world and form beliefs about the world. And, you know, there's been many people that kind of critique, and I think Balaji Srinivasan has said this recently, but he's kind of called the U.S. a Potemkin village, where we have, you know, shoddy institutions, or you know, we're projecting a facade that everything is okay, yet under the surface, you know, the system is kind of, you know, digesting itself from the inside out. Like, there is, you know, we think that we have wealth, yet it turns out to be paper wealth. And, you know, you could say, like, the emperor has no clothes, for example. And, you know, you also touched on kind of the need, where we have perceptions, and we also have the ability of other people to, I guess, give us their accounts of what they're experiencing to help us kind of grapple with things outside of ourselves, to form opinions and beliefs about the world and try to integrate other people's experiences. And so I think all this just opens up to me, like, you know, is there a way of kind of describing what the role of, people outside of ourselves, our social circle, our culture, and institutions more broadly, in terms of trying to understand the world and to get closer to knowing things or to have accurate beliefs?
Yeah, I'll say, so I gave you kind of the backstory of modern epistemology in Descartes' Meditations. It is a solo endeavor. It's Descartes sitting by the fire saying, what do I know? What is knowledge? Navel gazing, right? Just what you think of when you think of philosophy. And I also gave you kind of the aftermath of that endeavor. Like, we want a method that allows us to know the truth without trusting others. I mean, it's very Bitcoiner, right? Like, it's verify, don't trust. That was basically the impulse of Descartes. It also failed, and I say failed, I mean, it failed as an absolute rule for the mind. It can't be applied uniformly to everything and get you very far. And what the shift in epistemology sort of more recently has been towards social epistemology, recognizing that most of our beliefs are inherited. We can never achieve what another philosopher, Thomas Nagel, calls the view from nowhere, the unprejudiced, unbiased, objective view. It's theoretically impossible, really. It's theoretically impossible, not just practically impossible. We are beholden to others in all sorts of ways. And I mean, I guess I'll make the theoretical argument really quickly because I think it's important. When Descartes decides to doubt everything and let himself believe only the things that are immune to doubt, one of the things he's not doubting is his method. And his method is, if something survives radical doubt, it's true. That's not one of the things he's doubting. And if you really think about it, what would it be to doubt anything? You'd have to, I imagine myself as like cutting open my head and dumping all my beliefs onto the table and then examining those beliefs for some property of goodness and letting only the good ones back in. But when you imagine that, if you really dump all of your beliefs out on the table, dump out also the beliefs about what a good belief is, That's also one of the beliefs on the table. And you leave yourself no sorting mechanism to rebuild your beliefs. So the view from nowhere, it wasn't just that Descartes failed because he wasn't smart enough. It was something like the very project he was engaged in of aiming for absolute objectivity and absolute certainty was flawed from its very conception, right? So I think a lot of philosophy, epistemology has been about just existentially dealing with that fact. And what you're pointing out, and it's a solo endeavor, but epistemology, but what you recognize is your vulnerability and your dependence on the social, your parents, your school, your community, your country. And yet, in a way, epistemology will always be solo and will always be just you, because it's about how to form right beliefs. And that's a job that only you can do. You cannot outsource globally the job of forming beliefs. I mean, you can, but you have to decide who to outsource it to. You can just have like a cult leader and believe everything they say, but you got to decide which cult leader to believe, and nobody else can make, you can't like pass that decision off to a cult leader without deciding who to pass it on to. So in a way, if I could put the like modern epistemological predicament, epistemic predicament, it's really this. It's that you have a job that only you can do. It's first personal. It's unavoidable. You cannot shirk it. No matter how dumb you are, basically. Like, even if you're like, I'm not qualified to make this kind of decision, it's like, too bad. You have to make it. Only you can make it. Right? That's very Bitcoinery. Your epistemic responsibility is first personal, solo, and unshirkable. You cannot defer it to someone else. It's like holding your own keys, but there's no such thing as somebody custodying your mind for you. You can't custody your mind. Is self custody. You know, you can custody portions of it, but you have the ultimate, like, you have root access, and nobody else does. So. The predicament is you're stuck with this solo decision, this terrific responsibility of how to form beliefs and who to defer to, who to trust. And you cannot pass that along to anybody. But the question of who to trust has gotten really, really difficult because of the breakdown in institutions that you're pointing out, and I think all of us are aware of. I mean, in a way, this is what institutions are designed to solve. Our world is incredibly complex. We cannot be experts about everything. I'm in this field, epistemology and metaphysics. I can't even keep up with what's going on in my own fields. There's like hundreds of papers coming out constantly. I certainly can't keep track of what's happening across the fields of my colleagues, across the academy. The production of knowledge, it's like the hash rate. It's like, you know, just a spiking enormously. You can think of these knowledge facts, but of course, knowledge is produced across all of humanity, not just there. We've never produced knowledge at this astonishing rate. There's no way that we can individually keep up with it. It's not just the in principle problem of relying on others. It's just a matter of cognitive resources that we don't have. So we have to take shortcuts. And those shortcuts are like trusting people to guide us through their own areas of expertise. You learn about something, Spencer. I just say, you tell me about it and I'll trust you rather than like learning everything that you know myself. That's the basic function of epistemic institutions. And I think about it in terms of division of labor. I think the rest of the economy, not the knowledge economy. I don't make everything that I use. I mostly buy things that other people have made. And if you asked me to make everything that I use, it would be a very crude and primitive life. And it probably wouldn't even be a very long life. I don't think I could survive for very long. Honestly, if I had to make like everything, it would be like a naked and afraid, but you don't get any tools. You're just like dumped off into the wilderness with nothing, you know, like build everything, like find the metals, like, you know, smelt the ores. Like, I'm totally screwed. So, okay, that's for action. We totally understand the division of labor. It's at the basis of Aristotle's theory of the city. It's at the basis of Adam Smith. The reason we have a modern economy is because we specialize in trade. Okay, it's the same for knowledge. Why would it be any different for knowledge? Specialty knowledge is something we can each get by devoting an excess amount of time to a niche subject and coming to understand it. And then the natural thing is to trade that knowledge. Of course, the economy of trading knowledge is different. A lot of knowledge is free, and we don't trade in exactly the same way. But you rely on what I know, I rely on what you know, and we can conquer this very complex world of physics, chemistry, biology, economics, much better than if we each tried to know everything, like, from the bottom up, right? That would be an absolute disaster. So the problem is as soon as we begin to specialize and trade for knowledge, is that we have to, like, certify the goods that we're trading for, because you can fake knowledge, and you could be, like, basically relying on fool's gold, you know, instead of, you could be trading for counterfeit goods. And so we develop institutions to certify the non-counterfeit nature of propositional knowledge so that it can be traded and relied upon generally, right? Just like the UNESCO certifies food for safety. So you don't have to go into the, I mean, you don't have to go into, like, the slaughterhouse in Chicago and see what's actually going into the sausage. But, they'll send an inspector in there, and you trust that inspector is working for their boss at the FDA, and they want to do a good job and find people. And then you just get the FDA stamp, right? Basically, peer review, the whole system of universities, the government institutions, they are all systems of certifying knowledge so that we can overcome the basic epistemic predicament of being overwhelmed with too much to learn and not enough time and needing to rely on each other and not being able to figure it all out from the couch and from the fireside. And yeah, when those institutions break down, we're fucked. I mean, that's when those institutions break down, it's like we're back to the state of nature of everybody fending for themselves and learning everything from the ground up, which may sound romantic, but I guess my message as a professional epistemologist is like, that sounds like a total disaster to me. Sounds like a total disaster that we have to fend for ourselves. And to some extent, it sounds like it sounds like we're hearkening back to the original project of Descartes, which is awesome, but it's a kind of a dead end.
To follow up on that, I think I have two questions for you. One, are we fucked? And two, how do we make sure that we don't get fucked? So, you know, I guess a temperature check on the role of our knowledge institutions would be great. I'd just be curious, you know, like, do you find that we have an ability to create these institutions and sustain them in a way that is working? And then, you know, what can we do to try and influence that process? And I think, I think that'll also kind of take us down the rabbit hole of money a little bit too, but we can kind of leave that for a little bit later in the conversation.
Yeah. I wish I had some kind of magic solution. I just see the problem very clearly. I see the problem. The problem is, like, the role of the institution is a kind of epistemic power. They have knowledge power, and knowledge, they have the power to certify some things as true and other things as not true. I mean, this is the power of the editorial board at the New York Times and Washington Post. You know, it's the power of the Office of Science and Technology Policy for the White House. People will trust them. People will trust the American Medical Association, the FDA, whatever. These are all institutions of trust, and that trust translates into political power, right? Because, okay, now that I've got the the power to make people trust that what I say is true. Can I use that for my own advantage? Can I use that for the advantage of others? Can I sell it? All right. And human beings are fallible, and they can abuse their privilege that comes with epistemic authority. All right. So there's one kind of chink in the armor. Okay, we all rely on each other and trade, blah, blah. But now the institutions that certify truth can be captured, can be compromised, and used for political ends. Like, it's just another form of power. And what always happens with power and when people cede over their own ability to do such and such to a sovereign, the sovereign expands their power and abuses it. That's because that's what human beings do. Epistemology is not any different. And we know that'll happen. On the other hand, people who have a gripe with the institutions will set up counter narratives, whether or not those are true, for the same reason, and try to bootstrap themselves into epistemic power. And that also happens, right? And this is like kind of the essence of how disinformation works. You can destabilize a regime, or you can create social chaos by undermining sources of epistemic authority, even if they're legit, because you have something, I don't know, explosive, scary, false, completely made up, but nevertheless viral to share. And I think we've seen, just to stay on the diagnostic part, not the prescription part, we've seen both of those things happen. We've seen bad actors on both the kind of consumer critic side of epistemic production and also on the certification side, as everything has become swallowed by politics. The academy has become undoubtedly more political. There's an incredible skew of party membership inside of the academy broadly. The media has become polarized politically. The government maybe always was, but it seems especially so now. So these epistemic institutions, which we think of as playing a role that guides government, guides policy, guides political decisions. My father was at the University of Wisconsin, as he was an administrator there. The university was set up to inform legislators, right? It was like, well, educate the public, but the real function was lawmakers need to know the truth about things so they can make good decisions. So we need people to study the truth about things because the world is complicated, right? But now the academy is a political battlefield. It seems to have been swallowed by political interests and orientations. And so the certification function is hard to trust. It's hard to trust because you don't know whether it's a political power move or it's tribal signaling or whether it's a legit certification of knowledge. And so anyway, that's why, broadly speaking, we've got this breakdown of trust. It's happening for multiple reasons. I think within the academy, people are just like, they see the problem too, but they're like, oh, people are dumb. People are irrational. Like, why aren't they listening to us? Why aren't they, they basically need to be squelched. I think the most common opinion is just that we need to do a better job of solving misinformation, like, which means something like censoring. We need to do a better job of, we don't call it censorship, but nudging, like using the soft nudge of psychological manipulation and how we lay things out, which search results come up first and so on, to just gently guide people away from the crazy conspiracy theory stuff and back to the where they belong, the solid foundation of mainstream media, government, in the academy, right? And so I think the academy has not yet reckoned with, nor the media, nor the government, their role in eroding and collapsing these really vital human institutions of knowledge. They have yet to reckon with their role in it. It's all finger pointing, right? Which of course it's of course that's going to be the case. That's the way everything is now. It's just like, oh, there are forces trying to destabilize us. There are wackos out there. There are political radicals who are undermining our authority. And all they can think of is defense. They're not digging deeply down to the roots of why people have defected. They don't see those institutions as failing. Spencer, you said these institutions are failing. Like, I think a lot of people would disagree. They'd be like, no, they're not failing. People are just failing to get on board. That's the failure. The failure is in communication. Failure is not in the institutions themselves. Whereas I feel like a lot of what's happened is that the institutions have forfeited their trust. They earned it in a very painstaking way over decades, and are frittering away that epistemic capital, the trust capital that they built up. And I think, you know, the Bitcoin community is full of people who feel betrayed by those institutions, particularly on Bitcoin. But you'll find, of course, people who feel betrayed across multiple dimensions of human knowledge, whether that's health or climate or energy systems or basically anything, right? Bitcoiners are wide open, more than any other group, to heterodox views. And I think that's because the central thing that brings us together is Bitcoin, and we know how wrong, how pathetically wrong the institutions have been about Bitcoin. I mean, to the degree that, you know, you get more signal out of a Reddit thread in 2013 than you do out of, you know, someone who's supposed to know what they're talking about in 2020 or 2022 or 2023. You know, and it's like, how is this even possible? Craig Warnke, another philosopher at Northern Illinois, has this wonderful, like, ladder, the inverse prestige Bitcoin knowledge ladder. At the bottom of the ladder, you have the lowest prestige, epistemic prestige, and the most Bitcoin knowledge. And the higher you go on the prestige ladder, the less you know about Bitcoin, the less you care about it, right? So as soon as you see that everywhere, and the kind of cocksure condescension that comes with it, which is totally unearned, then, you know, you're like, okay, The institutions themselves are broken because they gave rise to this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I 100% agree with that perspective. And, you know, I think, like, the scary part right now, and I'm sorry to bring AI and these ideas into the mix, but, you know, we're used to video and voice and photo to be something that we can, like, rely on. And now all of a sudden, that can be changed. And on top of that, with these large language models, if they have a bias and that's not, you know, inherently disclosed or people can't verify that, you know, almost like if that's the interface that people get information, it's almost like the nature of information gets corrupted. And, you know, I thought that we were going to talk about Bitcoin in the context of, like, what it means to have, like, perfect pricing signals, but maybe it even makes sense to talk about Bitcoin as almost like a anti deep fake or a authentication mechanism for reality. I don't know if you've ever thought of it that way.
I have, and just to go back, what do you do with a philosophy degree? Well, I have students who are working on basically massaging AI, the epistemology of AI in the real world. Well, some of them are actually professors who are working on it in the academy, and some of them are engineers working on it technically. But I have students in both realms who are, like, tweaking the AI to not lead people astray. They're sensors, basically. They're sensors. They're working on censorship of some kind or other, right? I'm generally not someone who's afraid of AI. I think it's overall, I'm just bullish on it. But when it comes to, like, I don't think the AI is going to take over the world or start doing things autonomously. I've never been able to get worked up about that. But I am worried about it as an epistemologist for exactly the reason you said, CK. We can't rely on video and audio and pictures and movies. Like this is how we engage the world for the most part. We don't see each other face to face. I mean, we don't see our leaders that way. We don't hear things from their own ears, right? From their own mouths, with our own ears. Like, we engage the world digitally. Now that can all be manipulated. And I think that a lot of the way that we train AI is basically to fool us better and better. It's a really good bullshit machine. And I mean, some of what we're talking about here with the basic problem of epistemology, how to know the truth, is how to sort bullshit. And we outsource some of that sourcing of bullshit to trusted parties. We always have to do some of it ourselves because we have to decide who to trust. And we can't be taken advantage of. And what I think of sort of human evolution or even animal evolution, social evolution within animals, as an arms race of deception and deception detection. It actually begins with cooperation. Animals that cooperate do a better job surviving and reproducing than animals that don't cooperate. This is how communication evolves in the first place. Once communication evolves, if you can fool your communication partner into thinking you're cooperating while you defect in some joint endeavor, you let them face the danger and you reap the reward. So lying is good. It's adaptive. But species that detect liars do better than species that do not detect liars, or I should say, mutations that allow people to detect liars do better than the absence of those mutations. So you get this like arms race between systems of communication that allow you to cooperate better, and then systems which allow you to take advantage of that cooperation, and then systems that allow you to detect people who are taking advantage of it and punish them. So AI is like the next step in that evolution. It's the next step in the evolution of how to control the minds of others to your benefit. And I think it's scary because there isn't an equivalent bullshit detector evolution. We just got the bullshit creator has amped way up. We've gotten the next step of evolution on that, but we don't have the bullshit detection evolutionary step with it. So we're caught in a really weird moment in the evolution of communication, I would say, with AI. And Bitcoin gives us this little anchor. I see Jamie King in the audience. And Jamie, you should like join us if you'd like. And Matt Pines too, because Jamie's making a film right on this subject. We've had discussions about it.
Request if you want to come up.
But yes, and this is like, if you haven't read Gigi on Bitcoin is Time, you should read Gigi's essay. Bitcoin imposes an ordering on events that is non-arbitrary, and that's one of its core functions. And we have the ability to write things to the blockchain, arbitrary things to the Bitcoin time chain, I should say, and so as not to get canceled. And that allows us to timestamp events in the real world. Like, we really can say if we record something that's arbitrary on this chain, we'd say write down a headline about one country invading another, and we write something else on the next block. Those blocks will ever be in that order, and there's nothing an AI can do to change it. And likewise with proving your identity, it allows an infrastructure for proving your identity. So yes, I think of Bitcoin as offering some. To go back to Descartes grounded his knowledge on I think, the I think, therefore I am.
Right.
Bitcoin gives us a new Cartesian point of certainty I've said this to Jamie before, but it's like this Archimedean point that you can lever up on with the rest of your belief system. You can be certain that whatever's on the timeline is true. And not just the stuff about who has which addresses have what sats, but actually if there are events outside of the time chain recorded on it, you can be certain about the temporal ordering of those inscriptions. And that is profound. The evolution in the bullshit detection mechanism. Does it stand up to AI? And does it stand up to the collapse of these institutions? And does it stand up to the growing mistrust and this free invention of myriad new narratives? I mean, no. This is something I've also said to Jamie. As soon as we get just look at the disagreements in the Bitcoin community itself. Like, look at our disagreements. We disagree about basically everything that's not on the chain, including even the essential features of Bitcoin itself, right? Those disagreements are not settled by the hashing that's happening in the global network, right? The hash rate doesn't help us settle those networks. We can't, like, point back to the blockchain and say, you're right, I'm right, you're wrong. We manage to disagree about everything in a tribal and cultural way that it displays all of the same social features of epistemic dysfunction as the world at large. We do it right here in the Bitcoin community. So I think it would be very naively optimistic to say, we're going to build a new world on Bitcoin that solves these epistemic problems. I think that would be grossly unjust, given that we have not solved them for ourselves. Bitcoin has not solved it for us. And so, you know what I mean? Like, I'd love to have that message, like, Bitcoin fixes the breakdown of trust in institutions. I can't. I think it does in a very, very limited sense of ordering events in real life, preserving, basically it preserves information from being destroyed. It's the opposite of Orwell's memory hole in 1984. And the Ministry of Truth, you throw something in there and it disappears. It never happened. We have an annals here, a record that is immutable, and that does change the game. But I think we also have to be measured about how much of the epistemic problem it really solves, and it's not a lot.
Troy, could you rehash the question? Because I came in halfway through your riff there. I just want to make sure I'm not jumping into a completely incorrect context.
Yeah, Jamie, I think Troy, I mean, first of all, he was just kind of, setting you up to talk a little bit about the film you're working on. But mostly, I mean, I think it was just a question of, you know, what are the limits of what Bitcoin can fix for us from an epistemic perspective? And I think Troy did a good job laying out that kind of the onus of that still falls upon us as a culture. And, you know, there is a limit to what Bitcoin can fix in terms of helping us understand the world, but it does give us some affordance.
Well, interestingly, I was just discussing this in private with Matthew Pines earlier, so I tapped him to see if he'll come up as well. But I've got a few comments.
We have the whole panel here, so it's perfect.
Great. So, look, here's my take on it is that, and this is the context in which Troy and I have discussed this at some length for my film that I'm making, which is currently called Trust. And my perspective is that there has been an undeniable epistemic failure crisis across the board, and that one by one we have seen the great institutions failing in terms of people's trust for them, in terms of their capacity to project authority. And it's interesting, as an aside, to ask, to sort of iterate the reasons why this has happened, because one of them is to do with the very basis of Bitcoin, which is TCP/IP, the internet, decentralization, the principles of distribution, and so forth. All of those are played into what makes it hard to maintain narrative, what makes it hard to maintain authority. You can't stop the outpouring of voices, can't stop people tweeting, and so on and so forth. And so my film really takes that's the context in which the film takes place. And my perspective is a little more optimistic, I suppose, than Troy's, because here's what I think. I think that the entire history of modern history of institutions essentially relied on a technological context that is now over. And so we're in this period of epistemic crisis due to these network technologies that we all enjoy and we all use, but are now spinning off this kind of crazy epistemic chaos. And this behooves us to come up with solutions. And I think one of the things, and although Bitcoin is not the solution to the crisis writ large, which is what Troy is taking pains to point out, I do think it's extremely interesting as an epistemic artifact, because firstly, because it's sort of, it's one of the few inventions, you can call it that, and sort of Satoshi sets it up as a response to the problem of trust, you know, in his early writing. And secondly, because it goes about the it goes about the business of solving the problem of trust in a completely new way. In other words, it does not rely on the top-down mode of information production and distribution. It does not rely on authority. It doesn't rely on trusted third parties and intermediaries. And that makes it, you know, besides anything else, that makes it interesting as an epistemic art, not extremely interesting as an epistemic artifact, because it obtains its, when we were talking about this the other day, drawing a roundabout way, but it obtains whatever credence we have in it, whatever functionality it obtains, is not got by demanding authority, insisting on authority, promulgating authority through, you know, narrative, through men in gray suits who tell you this is the credible one, you know, this is the real one, this is the one you have to trust. And that is new, like, since the birth of broadcast media. And so my take on it is, and this is what Matthew and I were discussing today, that although, you know, it only sort of does one thing, right, which is to tell you that one Bitcoin is one Bitcoin, the kind of Gigi, you know, thesis, that is still incredibly profound. This is why Troy is using this term, the Archimedean point of certainty. What Pines is saying is, and what Pines was saying to me today, with which I agree, is that it's that fulcrum around which you can build, or it's that pivotal point around which you may then be able to build other kinds of institutions. Because we have had other kinds of institutions that function in a non-top-down, non-authoritarian way, that have been able to afford immense degrees of coordination to us. For example, free software, huge, huge change in the modality of production of software, and it's the best. As we would like Bitcoin to be the best money, free software is the best software. I think it's no longer a question. Peer-to-peer file sharing, the best form of distributing media, free software, not top-down, distributed, and so on. So there have been models before. One might say Nostr is going to be an example. And so what I'm interested in is not specifically whether Bitcoin solves the quote-unquote epistemic crisis, problem of not how to know something and so on in itself, because I don't think it does, but whether it's an example of a new strategy for letting us reach a degree of social coordination, a degree of epistemic harmony, as it were, without the need for authority and without the requirement for this old outmoded form of information technology that is now clearly, you know, clearly not coming back. Is that clear as a thesis?
I mean, that's wonderful. That's wonderful, Jamie. I mean, I love it. And I think the question, and it's a practical one, which is how far does that kind of model, do those models spread? And can they encompass medicine? Can they encompass climate science? can they encompass entomology, right? Like what parts of our epistemic lives can those sorts of institutions that pattern or form of cooperative behavior swallow? I mean,
yeah, funny you should ask that, because that's exactly how I'm going to end the film, with that question. And I think with that question and one other, which is related to BlackRock, which is the question of what do we need to watch out for in terms of ways the model could then be recaptured, you know, could then re-territorialized in unexpected ways. And maybe Pines can speak to that. But the optimistic part of me, of which, you, as you know, is quite a large part of me, says that you'd never have expected when Microsoft was the dominant model of software production, which it was, for those of us old enough to remember, you'd never have expected Richard Stallman and his cronies to be able to create a new model of free software production that would rival it and eventually outmode it. When Satoshi created Bitcoin, there's no way you would have expected this model to become a serious contender for hard money,
right?
And possibly, and so when you, I could say similar things about Pirate Bay or BitTorrent. The scale that BitTorrent went to and is still at one point it accounted for over 30% of traffic on the internet, BitTorrent alone. And when you take into account that those types of capacity, those unexpected capacities, I think you can at least can make the conjecture that it could spread wider than we think and be more successful than we think. But I also think it's extremely interesting to ask how far it can go and what are its limits, because really you're asking us, you're asking the oldest political question, which is, how far will we go? What will we do to get social coordination? How much will we relinquish in terms of privacy, in terms of safety, in terms of, and Bitcoin appears to say, hey, look, I can prove that you can have money without totalitarianism. And that's pretty big in terms of the history of that conversation, which is always bounced between those two modes, right? Sorry, you need big state if you want good systems. Yeah, or we're going to have small state and you're all going to duke it out and be smallholders or whatever. And this seems to get you somewhere in the middle or gets you somewhere new in that argument, which I think is brilliant, and suggests that the unexpected may be possible.
My question for both of you is to that very point. What's the distinction between a reliable, accurate record and an authoritative record? Right, because that seems to be really the critical question that you're drilling around, which is if you have a system that provides, you know, reliable and accurate records, which is a solid foundation, but maybe a necessary but not quite sufficient condition for generating authoritative knowledge, which is a sociological process, and that's over into the Troy camp.
Well, I mean, if I can jump in on this, I'll say, I think that the authority is earned from reliability over time. And obviously it can be manipulated by any other way that people get manipulated. But I think Bitcoin will prove its authority over time through its reliability. And I think, you know, CK, you mentioned you were going to talk about price signals. I think that price signals are a check on abusive epistemic authority. To Jamie's point, like when does political authority get undermined? When is something an authoritative record, and when does it lose authority? One of those spaces in which records lose their authority is when they prove their unreliability and getting food into your mouth, right? Like when you can say whatever you want as a leader, but if you're not meeting people's basic needs, your authority is undermined. So think about the long lines in Soviet Russia, like before the fall, the bread lines. There was a reality. You could have all the propaganda you wanted about how the rest of the world was even worse, but when people are hungry, they start to suspect something. And I think money has played this role of, or I should say, trades generally. When you trade X for Y, there's truth in that. That's another like Cartesian point. You can either afford to eat or you can't. Someone either accepts your offer or they refuse it. And like, think about Bitcoin and all of the mythology that we build up around its price. Very recently, we've had the stock to flow, Plan B model discussion. We build models. We build narratives around Bitcoin. The reality of Bitcoin is in two things. It's in the blockchain itself, whatever's on everybody's nodes, but it's also in the price. You know, you can say Bitcoin's worth nothing, like Paul Krugman or most of the economics profession. And what's undermining the economist's authority is price. It's the fact that people are not willing to sell their Bitcoin for nothing. But they're demanding like $30,000 for a Bitcoin. So suddenly the authority is stripped from the economics profession because they're interfacing with something outside the hierarchy that they've built for themselves of expertise. And right, this goes back to the Bitcoin is Venice opening, where it's the different styles of mixed martial arts that meet, and jiu-jitsu ultimately wins out over, and Muay Thai win out over the other martial arts. It's the bullshit up against the reality. But that reality, even that kind of meeting real physical needs in the real world, can be disguised for a long time with the manipulation of money. Right? The manipulation of money can allow political leadership to sort of fake that we're doing better than we are because we're borrowing from the future in ways that won't be our problem, will be with someone else's problem. I think Bitcoin, not entirely, but to a large degree, fixes that kind of lying and forces accountability forces a kind of accountability throughout the world systems that check various pretend authorities, right? And so, yeah. Bitcoin, but sort of by aligning itself with the structure of scarcity of the real world and sending true price signals, it gains authority through its own reliability. But it's also just like it gains authority through NGU. Ultimately, the network is still here, and it continues to become more valuable over time. And it continues to undermine the narratives about its imminent demise. That have come from whatever it is. I mean, basically every institution, the Bank of International Settlements, the World Bank, the IMF, the Fed, the government. Basically, everybody has said this thing is a joke and it'll go away, and it didn't. So it's egg on everyone's faces, right? Sorry, that was a long-winded way of answering your question.
Troy, I was going to say my favorite is the WEF in 2017 claiming that by 2020, Bitcoin would use 100% of the Earth's energy.
Yeah, and Newsweek, don't forget. It was the cover of Newsweek as well.
That was a great one. I mean, hey, Jamie, Matt, didn't expect you to be on the show, but, obviously added a lot. Jamie, really, really great stuff. I think you added a lot to the conversation. Maybe you should be coming on Cosmic Bitcoin, just throwing it out there. But Troy, where do you want to go with talking about Bitcoin and the future of just knowledge? For me, I like to say 37 sats. No one can be bullish enough. 37 sats. will equal generational wealth. That's the block award in 95 years. You know, when I look back at what the world was like 95 years ago, you know, we wouldn't recognize how people live. And I think that that's going to be the case in the future. And if Bitcoin is truly this evolution in knowledge, something that we can build a foundation for the future on, you know, I think that it's impossibly bullish enough on humanity. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that perspective.
I don't know about your argument there. I don't know if I agree. I agree that we don't know, that we can't possibly know what things are going to be like then. And I think Bitcoin has a pretty good chance of being around there then. And I have no idea how much you know, the block reward will be worth in terms of other goods at that point, whether it'll be generational wealth. I'll say, when I came on the scene, 2011, nobody thought of Bitcoin as inevitable. Quite the opposite. Even Gavin, who was running Bitcoin at just, you know, after Satoshi handed the reins over from the project, like, he said it would probably fail. He publicly said, Bitcoin will likely fail, but, you know, there's this massive upside if it doesn't. So I'm sort of I'm not in that camp, because I think we are 12 years later now from when he said that. And I think we've got a 12-year track record. And to Matthew's point, Bitcoin has earned some authority at this point through its reliability. But I'm not really confident about what will happen multi-decades into the future. I hope you're right. I like the vision. I'm more of a, maybe this is why I'm not rich, because I sort of agreed with Gavin at the time. I was like, yeah, this is an experiment, like an awesome experiment. I want to be a part of it, and I want to try to make it happen, and, you know, spend as many sats as I can and make the circular economy happen. But I guess I'm like, I know Matt Pines is the same way. We're Bayesians, right? We have degrees of belief between 0 and 1, and we update on the basis of incoming evidence. So if I was at, like, maybe I would say I was at something like a 0.01 credence that Bitcoin would succeed in 2011 or something like that. I actually, that it would ever reach the market cap of gold. I actually did this kind of calculation when I decided to buy Bitcoin, because I decided the probability that it would reach the market cap of gold was great enough that it had a positive expected utility. But, you know, every year it gets updated and more strongly, but I'm nowhere near certainty, man. I'm nowhere near that, like, Cartesian point of certainty. It's just more like the best horse in the race that I see. And I think it's underestimated by the market, and I'm still very bullish. But, you know, yeah, long term, I have no idea. Where should we go from here in the conversation? I don't know. I think Jamie wrapped things up really beautifully. I want to see if Matt Pines wanted to say more than just ask the question. Matt, do you have a spiel you want to dump on us?
I guess one related spiel, going back to something you mentioned earlier with, like, the, you know, one aspect of diagnosing our current predicament, right? Which you first want to diagnose the problem before you, you know, try to think about potential solutions and make sure you understand all the different dimensions of the pathology to understand if the, you know, prospective solutions are actually going to, you know, resolve all of those potential issues. And I think one potential pathology that you touched on, which is a slightly different aspect of our predicament, is, you know, what I would call maybe, like, epistemic volatility, right? In the sense that because the rate of knowledge production is so fast, that, you know, you by sort of backwards induction, you have to discount how much credence you put on your present beliefs, because your expectation is that you're going to learn more things faster than you ever have in the past. And so you should sort of bake in a higher degree of uncertainty in your present beliefs, which can actually, that can be rational, but it can also lead to kind of a doom loop where you sort of suspend belief overall, and there's a collective action problem with that, where everyone sort of, you know, if everyone suspends belief, right, and then everyone jumps around from belief to belief, right, it just becomes a kaleidoscope of ever-shifting sort of epistemic hall of mirrors, where nobody trusts that anyone else will sort of reliably stick to any particular coherent, worldview. And that just sort of fractures any sense of like a common reality, right? And I think you see that explicitly on social media, but I think it plays out in a larger domain. And I think like the inverse of epistemic volatility, right, is trust, right? Like if you have, like there's a sweet spot, right? If you have like super slow epistemic volatility, like knowledge doesn't change at all, that's like totalitarianism. That's just like, you know, the book of truth is handed down to you on high. And, you know, the liturgy and the canonical beliefs don't change for millennia. And that is a failure mode that we're familiar with in human history. I think we're exploring a failure mode on the other end of the spectrum, where the rate of production of new knowledge, or what passes as knowledge, has all the sort of like prior markers of what we used to think of as knowledge sort of flip by our screens and feeds so quickly. And even in the sort of the more official channels of knowledge production, as you mentioned, right, like journal articles and sort of just volumes of material and information that is generated from human production, and is only poised to get, you know, exponentially worse as you get sort of AI emulating machines, human emulating AI machines that can produce, you know, facsimiles for now, and maybe even, you know, faithful versions of knowledge production activities that are currently, you know, occupied by human minds. And I think that is a, I don't know what you would call that, but that is a distinctive type of failure mode that I don't think we've ever confronted before. And I, you know, as a pathologist, you know, that's like diagnosing a pathology, potential, you know, problem we have in our, you know, epistemic environment driven by the sort of socio-technical systems that we're sort of hitched to, and our minds are kind of, you know, embedded in. And I just, you know, I like Bitcoin, but like, I don't know how Bitcoin itself is the solution to that, right? Like, that even if you get the reliable, accurate record, if you get a billion of those records, you know, pumped into your cornea every second, right, can you do much with it, right? So how do you get to a pace that is suitable for just what the human prefrontal cortex is able to process?
Totally.
A separate problem.
I would say there's an individual version of this and a social version of this. You know, there's a big topic in epistemology is epistemic conservatism. And how much do you anchor on your present beliefs and slowly update? Like me with my uncertainty about Bitcoin, like how do I slowly update? And how much do you optically and sort of abandon, you know, but you're not tied down by your previous beliefs. And you kind of get pathology on both sides of the, in both extremes. And there's some kind of Aristotelian mean to be found between those extremes. The philosophers tend to be very open to criticism, and sometimes when they age, different things happen. They can like stop being as open to criticism, sort of rigidify. But another thing that happens to old philosophers is that they become rootless. Every argument they hear that's a good argument, they're no longer like totally smart enough to tear it apart. So they're talking to people who are 30 years younger and smarter. They just get convinced both ways, right? And you can't live like that. You can't live while being convinced of opposite truths every 10 hours, you know? And there's something like you're kind of pointing out, your volatility is kind of pointing out that phenomenon at a social scale. It's like the shared beliefs can be fragile in the same way. And you look at institutions like religion. Actually, one of my profs used to say about religion and science that religious beliefs vary across space, but not time, because, you know, people have very different religious beliefs from different cultures, but they believe the same things that they believed hundreds of years ago. But science is the opposite. You have a difference across time because we're drinking from the fire hose of knowledge, but you have sameness across space because, like, the leading labs in the world all agree on the basic scientific truths, no matter where they are. And I don't know if that's a cheap shot against religion, but forget the religion and science thing for a moment and just think about the dimensions about which he's speaking.
Right.
We have institutions like religion that kind of slow down the pace of belief change, because you have to kind of fit everything new into this religious system, and political ideology can work in the same way. You have some kind of overarching worldview or ideology. It's like this conservative, it has this conservative effect on belief. And I don't mean that to be a bad thing. I mean, that's kind of a protection against what you're talking about, Matthew. It's like, it's a protection against getting overwhelmed by novelty across many dimensions. And so that you're like these old philosophers who kind of forget what they believe and they're just rootless, right? So you need some kind of basic orientation towards life that is like stable in order to build on it. Another reason that we like stability in belief formation, in this goes back to something I said at the very beginning, is that belief is also part of the action stack, I want to say. Remember at the beginning, I talked about how epistemology is about mind-world fit, but the direction of fit is mind to world. You're conforming your mind to the world. So you're on this receiving side of the stream of new information, and you're trying to update your mind to map the complexity of reality in real time. But the other form of rationality of mind world fit is conforming the world to your mind. And that's another, belief is involved in that process as well. And CK, your conviction about, what was it, 37 sets? Like, that's partly bringing that reality into existence, right? The collective belief in Bitcoin is what creates demand for it. And so it's not just, and I say this like it's news to you, that it's news to nobody but me, right? I'm so much on the conforming my mind to the world side because I'm an academic. I don't presume that I have any power to change things. I presume, you know what I mean? I'm trying to map reality, not to create it. But our beliefs do both. And when you have a stable, conviction in some deep principle, then you have something to build a plan of action around and bring other people into that plan. And stable beliefs aren't just good because you need to anchor the flashes of momentary differences in your mind over time to inquire, but they're especially valuable when you are trying to bring a kind of reality into existence. And that's part of Bitcoin, right? So, always in Bitcoin and really in the money world in general, I'm always trying to sort through when somebody's telling me something, are they telling me this because they figured it out and it's true and they're relaying it to me? Are they telling me this because by telling me, they're likely to make it real, right? I think the truth is always somewhere in between, right? It's always somewhere in between. It's never as neat as just conforming your mind to the world, right? That's a thought. But to your point, Matthew, like the volatility index of belief, yeah, we're shooting up in terms of volatility, and I think Bitcoin does not, like the chain doesn't actually protect against that. The ideology that's building around Bitcoin might function like, I mean, think about the resistance to changing the code. it's a conservative, quasi-religious psychological force that, you know, it checks momentarily chasing after like, oh, this proposal looks pretty good. That proposal looks pretty good. Oh, I think I'm going to look out into the entire field of blockchain technologies and pluck some and update Bitcoin's code that way. We actually drank for the fire hose of technological improvement possibilities, and for many Bitcoiners, myself included, it was just overwhelming. And at least for a time, we just shut it down with a kind of religious orthodoxy of like, the Bitcoin's good enough. Like, let's just leave it alone for a while. But actually, I like some of those proposals. I like the, you know, I like 300 and 301. I like covenants, whatever. I'm interested in that. But I think that you can see even within the Bitcoin community, this interplay of getting overwhelmed with information and then retreating actually to something a little more stable because it's too overwhelming.
And Troy, I say this in jest, but I did not have a call for a Bitcoiner, Butlerian jihad to stop the exponential improvement of technology as part of our conversation today. I think that conversation of trying to understand and dance with both of those failure modes, whether that's conservatism or hyper novelty and trying to navigate that is something that you know, we should certainly explore further. Unfortunately, we do have a hard stop coming up on this riff right here. And just want to thank you all for joining us today. This was absolutely fascinating. So I guess for each of y'all, I'd just like to give, you know, Jamie, Matt, and Troy the opportunity. You know, is there anything you're working on lately that you want to, you know, show for the audience? Matt, I'll just note that I got your book Expectation Value in the mail recently. So looking forward to digging into that. And Jamie as well. I know Troy noted you're working on a film titled Trust. So if you want to, you know, say any words on that, I'm sure the audience would be interested in hearing about it.
Sure, sure. You can check out the old trailer. Is at trust.film. The film is fully funded now, I'm happy to say. So we'll 100% be finishing it. Troy's been interviewed. Matt's been interviewed, amongst a whole bunch of other interesting people. The thesis has changed a little bit because I've been working on this project for so long. But very roughly, it's what we've just been talking about. It positions Bitcoin as a very important, perhaps the most important emergent technology in this context of epistemic crisis. So it's sort of part one, there's an epistemic crisis and a huge breakdown. Part two, why is it happening? And part three, what are some of the approaches to quote unquote fixing it? And Bitcoiners will know the two options. One is the evil empire, CBDCs, and so forth. That layer of direct control, and the revolutionary branch is of course our branch, the resistance, which is coordination without control. So new types of coordination, like Bitcoin, new tech that can afford coordination without the necessity for authoritarian control, and that's essentially the thesis of the film. It'll take me another year to finish it, but anybody who wants to offer ideas, get involved in any way, just chat with me, keep me from going crazy, you know, drop me a line.
Fantastic, thanks Jamie. I'm sure, you know, I'm personally I'm stoked to give that a watch once that comes out. That sounds fascinating if it's anything like the conversation we've had today. Troy, you have any parting words for the audience?
Well, first of all, just thanks again for having me on and let me ramble about this stuff. Really great conversation, and thanks to Matt and Jamie for coming up. In terms of what I'm working on right now, I just started a nonprofit called the Nakamoto Project, and we're another 501c3 pending, designed to educate and inspire people about Bitcoin. And if that's the kind of thing that interests you, our goal is to reach people kind of where they're at the most normie capacity that we can. And through mass media. So I'm an intellectual, but this is not an intellectual project. This is basically a marketing ploy. So if there's something interests you, reach out to me and talk. But thanks again for having me.
Of course, anytime, Troy. This was an awesome conversation. And I'll just thank you all again on behalf of myself and CK. I really appreciate all of y'all coming on and sharing your thoughts. So without further ado, I think that's a wrap on Cosmic Bitcoin. And again, appreciate y'all coming on and hope to chat soon. Peace out.
Thank you, everyone. Peace. See you in Amsterdam.
Absolutely.